You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
This is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That. Welcome back for part two of this wild and crazy talk with the men of the Hot Wing Kings, which was Katori Hall's play at the Signature Theater.
I had a thought about education that I wanted to bring in because I was watching this documentary about racism in the evangelical church. And it was talking about how Native voices have been pushed out of the, in terms of like evangelical Christianity sweeping across the United States and Canada. And they were talking about in Canada how these young Native girls were put into these re-education schools to be taught how to be Canadian.
Right.
To be taught how to be white Canadians.
Correct.
And they were they were separated from their families. They were separated from the people of the
Get the Indian out of them.
And yeah, teach the Indian out of them. And I don't think that that is different than the education system in the United States.
Agreed.
For black people, where it is trying to, by virtue of whitewashing history, of literally just not teaching the history of this country. And I'm not talking about African-American history. I'm talking about American history. You cannot divorce the two. To not teach American history as it is, not trying to protect white people's feelings as you teach it, but to teach it as it is and as it happened, and the effects that we're now dealing with the reverberations of today is to try and strip black people of the knowledge that they are using to individuate it, and then all of the ways that black people are punished within the education system. Your son being an example, mm-hmm. Your story to Sam being an example. That the numbers of black people being punished at higher rates in education is ridiculous. But when you think about the unconscious and the conscious ways that that happens, mm-hmm. I started reflecting on that, Corey, and being like, okay, so unconsciously, you're not aware of your unconscious bias. You may be like unconsciously punishing more because of, you know, stimulus that you've received over the course of your life you're not aware of. But then on a conscious level, you could think you're doing the right thing. There's this young black boy in this class, and I know the statistics for black men. Ooh, I'm gonna make sure that I punish him now. I'm gonna make sure that he gets that detention for pushing down a 4-year-old who can barely stand. Cause this way, when he gets and becomes a big black man, he's not gonna be violent. I'm gonna help to get that out of him now. Mm. So there are conscious ways that people could think that they're doing the right thing. Or I'm gonna help usher him out of this. And that is super scary. That you think you're doing the right thing by traumatizing children.
I don't know that they think about us like that. I don't think they think about us like that. No. I don't think so. Go on, Steve. Tell us about your childhood in Arkansas. I got folks from Arkansas. Forest City. My folks from Forest City.
You lying.
No.
Little Rock, Arkansas, born and raised. Mm. Born and raised. No.
I will say that I often find that the South is a little less racist than the North. The South is a little less racist.
I grew up, and there were two worlds in the South, black and white. I don't remember Latino. I don't remember nobody else but black and white. I grew up, I wasn't raised by my mother or my father. My grandmother raised me. But it was in a very... Blackness is all I knew. Two blocks down the street was Daisy Bates from me. I lived next to Daisy Bates. She helped integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Two blocks. So I remember my grandmother cooking food, and I didn't know who she was at the time, but I would go to her house to bring her food. I went to a black church, grew up Baptist. All my environment was black. All I saw was examples of black middle class. You know what I mean? But to grow up black, black, to grow up male, to grow up then gay, or same gender loving, was the shift. You know what I mean? My environment didn't explore it religious wise. I grew up thinking, you know, typical Baptist, it was a sin. You know, we want to get that out of you. So I learned very, very soon to, I remember coming home one day to my grandmother, and after having attraction for another young man, just didn't know it was wrong. I went like, Mama Louise, I like such and such. And she went, what? And I knew in that look immediately that that wasn't tolerated, accepted. And through the church, I went to church every Sunday in our church home and stuff was very important in our home. I knew quickly that that was part of myself that I had to hide. So I went on that hiding probably for up to 30 years.
Wow.
And how I did it was just, I just wiped that part out of me. You know what I mean? I said, if I didn't have to acknowledge it, if I didn't, people would think, are you like asexual? Like, what's up with you? But I was just like, learn how to pass, learn how to be at my barbershop and not be detected, learn how to go in very hyper-masculine black spaces and be accepted. That's what I learned, to just mask up and learn how to survive and ignore any type of sexuality in my... That's why I'm so versed on it now, because it took until I got to college and grad school to have any sense of an acknowledgement of who I was and trying to discover, and I went on a quest for all of that information. But
that means through your adolescent years where we're exploring our sexuality, you had shut that shit down.
I didn't do... Do you hear me? Anything. I didn't do anything because I was fearful. I was fearful, and I was told very quickly that shouldn't happen and that that could even be death. That's what I thought. And I grew up in the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a point of lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, fear, shame, belittlement. That's how I grew up. So I just learned to just hide, hide and pass. Then my grandmother would raise, I think, of Dominique Morisseau's Pipeline. Her whole, I empathize with that, of mothers, women of color, and I think about you and you said your sons, in the quest to just have their children survive. Mm. And you know what I mean? Survive this systemic injustice, because it's already planned that we would go from the cradle to prison. Mm-hmm. That's what's expected of us. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother, single woman, did everything she could so that I could be educated and survive. Mm. But then when you get educated, like you said, I went to white institutions primarily. So then there's this sense of Uncle Tom syndrome, mm-hmm. that I have been taught to please, to be safe, not be threatening. You know, and as long as I can please the overseer, I was rewarded. You know what I mean? And that's all I knew until I got to graduate school. And then there's some sense of, I can think on my own. I can have my own thoughts. I don't just have to regurgitate information back to you. I can critically think for myself. But I've always, you know, had on my own quest of writers of color, of scientists of color, of artists, our people. I was on my quest because I grew up around a black environment. That's all I knew. And then I keep jumping because I look at you only because I'm also a professor at Penn State University. I was head of the MFA acting program, and he came through the program. And how did I find myself as the educator, the black male that was the head of something? You know what I mean?
How did you?
Listen, by the grace of, you know what I mean?
You must have been tap dancing ass off.
I remember, literally, I remember the day I discovered that and felt so shameful and bad because I said, oh my God, I have been part of the Uncle Tom syndrome. And I was even to the point. I don't know if you remember this. I remember Cecil came to class, and one of his other classmates, I pulled him aside in my office. I was like, listen, because the history of the school was black men didn't survive there at our school. They will get you out and cut you and out of the program. And I remember him and a friend, another black male, bringing them in and going, y'all, listen, y'all got to sit in the front row. Y'all got to be on time, be early. Pull out your notebook and pretend like you're writing notes. Even if you not look like you're writing notes.
I did. That's what I did.
Don't wear your hat to class. You have to look a certain way. And then I felt shame because I was training you to be in this oppressive environment. Mm. The very thing I had been trained and how I got to where I was. Isn't that messed up?
Yeah, that's but it was how you had to survive, though.
But it's so important.
I mean, it's like I had to tell my son, we got to cut the locks now. They starting to see you in a certain way. We got to take your locks off.
But it was so important, though, like, because, like, I know I could only imagine that position, but, like, you're the reason I went there. Like, if you were not in that position, I would not have went there. So, like, you, and there's Eric, there's a bunch of dudes can, like, attest to that. So, it's like, it's so important. Like, and you fought for that when he was in Toronto. Remember, you like, there's no black teachers here.
Yeah.
And they not understand. They couldn't even get it in their worldview. They're like, what? They were offended. They're like, are you saying I can't teach students because I'm not black? And you're like, bro, we just want
to see ourselves. We want to see ourselves. And then this ideal of what the bar is, because I mean, you can't say that, but I'm about to say it. A lot of these higher education institutions, I mean, let's be clear, is white schools of theater, white schools that teach Eurocentric value as the default. Mm. And if you don't fit into that, it's problematic. Mm. So I have a problem with that as an educator. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? We need to diversify the faculty, whose administrators, who the deans are, who the principals are, so that the curriculum can diversify. But listen, you want us to learn Eurocentric
value. But you know, I got to say, as a teacher, I've been teaching at NYU Atlantic School, and I rarely have students of color. But if I have at least one student of color, it allows me to teach a little bit differently.
Yes.
Because they can let everybody know that how I'm being is okay.
Yeah.
This last year, I had no students of color. And I had, my reviews were terrible. I really would be surprised if I even get invited back. They were like, I was the worst teacher they ever had. It was the, you know, the worst class in their history. And many of my complaints were that it was so punitive of me to have them read August Wilson monologues.
Mm.
I'm sorry. I don't know if I just blew out that mic.
But it's like, that's I might not get a job again because they get to write those things. And I had them, and it was one day, the final class, I had them read August Wilson monologues. That was punitive of me. Multiple people complained about that.
Yeah, I find it amazing though, there are many thoughts that I've had in this last 5 minutes, but how perception is so the forefront of how we judge people and how we like what we take away from what somebody says. It's like, there was this amazing voice teacher that I had when I was in grad school, and it was so interesting to hear how students that were not of color would talk about her. And it was like, she's the bomb. Like, she's telling you as it is. She doesn't have sugar with what she's saying. She's just saying, this is what it is.
Is she of color?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, she's amazing. Uh-huh. Fran Bennett, amazing woman. But the way in which people talk about her that were not of color, it was like, you don't understand. Like, I want to say that this is mama. This is grandmama. Like, she just has a different way of talking to you that's not going to coddle you and make you feel good, because that's probably not how she grew up. That's not the struggle she went through in life, was being people being gentle to her. She had to have a tougher skin in order to communicate what she needed and communicate her needs. And so it wasn't gonna be, oh, let me take care of you, baby. She was not a mammy. Mm-hmm. She was the instructor of that class, and she was gonna tell you what you needed to know. If you didn't like how she said it, that's not on her. That's on you to understand your own insecurities and your ego and where you need to place that. But how people receive teachers of color is, I mean, from grade school, I forget who said it, my first black teacher was Miss McKibben. She taught me science in fifth grade, and she was a savior. Like, it was amazing to see myself in science and to be curious about that knowledge, because I had never seen, I didn't have a black teacher ever again before. My mother was a teacher, but she wasn't my teacher. So I don't know, but I'm just thinking about perception and like how people perceive one another. And you don't know the traumas that people have gone through. If you don't ask, you will never know. And you still may never understand it or empathize with it, Let me get emphasis correct. But everybody that I know has grown up with some sort of trauma that has stunted them or propelled them in some way, that when you're coming together in a group of people, it's difficult to say, you don't always match because you're on different levels of understanding. And just to take the time to step back and look at what is being given to you versus how you initially feel about it, I think is more powerful and more, you're gonna gain so much more from that. I mean, like, punitive, please. August Wilson.
I'll say on a somewhat hopeful note, you know, I'm an alumni of NYU's grad acting program, and recently, last spring, I had the opportunity to go back as a, they have a program called the diversity mentorship program where alums can come back and shadow one of the faculty members there and work with students for a semester. And I worked with the voice teacher, Scott Miller, with the first year class last year. And they have started at the request of the students. What I will say is great, you know, I enjoy the point is they do listen. They listen and they try to give the students what they ask for to the best of their ability. And they started, they brought in Michelle Shea to lead a August Wilson workshop with the entire first year class last week, which I sat in a couple.
Yeah, Felicia Rashad came in and talked about, you know, a school-wide panel about August Wilson as like a as classics.
Yeah, as classics. The way the way that we were asked to study Arthur Miller and Clifford Odets and Tennyson, you know, like why
and Shakespeare
and Shakespeare. Why is not August Wilson considered amongst those, you know, the
He is, you know, so
the fact that and it was such a success and the entire class loved it so much and I was able to sit in on a couple sessions. It was proven to them that now they see there's value. But we always knew there was value, but to get a program like that to acknowledge the value, you know, it was refreshing. I'm like, okay, this is a progress, you know. So I'm hopeful that they will continue to move in that direction. But it is sometimes like pulling teeth to get these institutions to change, to get out of the crotchety old, you know, crap they've been using since 1945, and see the world in a different. It's like there's so many players, and I'm not even talking about like August Wilson's great, but August Wilson ain't the only black playwright that we need. You know what I'm saying? Like there's new stuff. There's refreshing new writers out here. Like let's do your homework. I'm big. Any teacher of actors at any institution is like, do your homework too. Like, go find the material. I had a teacher who actually asked me for a list of, she's like, could you give me a Lisa Benavides? Thank you, Lisa. She's like, do you have a list of writers and plays that I could be looking at as I teach? And like, you know, and like, because I understand it's a lot of material. They're very busy and there's a lot of material.
There's Google.
There's Google. But you know, I appreciated the fact that she at least asked for help and, you know, in getting those materials together. I take it. But so
lazy. She get paid to do that.
She get paid to go
on Google and find
out. It take a village. It take a village.
She needed to be able to pick up her phone book and go, ooh, other playwrights, other teachers, please.
Look, I love Lisa. She is the reason, one of the big reasons the August was Michelle Shea was there.
We'll give Lisa a little bit of props.
Yeah, but so my thing is, it's like, these resources, these materials that these old, you know, these institutions seem somehow to not be aware of is like,
willful
come on, ignorance. let's get up to date. Like, if I see one more damn egg scene from A Raisin in the Sun, and like, it's like the only scene that they know. It's like every black man that come in, but it's like every black man that come through has had to, you know, it's like there are others, you know, and every black man is not Walter Lee, you know, or doesn't need to, not to say they can't play the role, but it's like, let's mix it up. Let's get some, you know, different material out here.
And it makes me think of like what you said about that freshman year class, how what they thought of that class and how amazing it was to have that perspective that they all had to learn August Wilson as part of the classics. What they got out of that. Mm-hmm. What we get as black actors from having to take in a world of theater that does not include us. We learn to exist outside of ourselves in new ways.
And we learn to embody other people. I mean, the first time I did this with a set of students that responded really well to it, what was exciting to me was they all came in. This was a class that responded well. They came in and they were like, it's just so big. There's a lot of power. There's a lot of energy. I'm like, yeah, black people, the taxi driver, the shoe shine, they living with that kind of power all the time. It's an opportunity to embody a whole nother life that we have to do all the time.
All the time.
And it uses so little of us.
And so it makes me go, if you're unwilling to embrace and even try to be exposed to things outside of your experience, then how are you going to learn to actually do the job?
But they don't have to because the world was made for them to be comfortable. And so when you ask them to step into an August Wilson or a Katori Hall, it's not comfortable. And when the world was designed for your comfort, like I always say to my, I've dated a lot of white men, I'm uncomfortable all day long, every day. So I just made you uncomfortable. Join me. This is my life. We are used to just being uncomfortable all the time. And you ask them to be uncomfortable for an hour, it's a big ask.
And you get blame because if the world is designed for you to feel comfort and you make me feel uncomfortable, you're the problem.
Yep.
You're the problem. And you experience this. I know I've experienced this a lot doing plays that are for Black people and are written by Black people, that white people who come and see the plays, often they can connect to many things about it. But if there's ever anything that makes them feel outside of the experience, they're like, something that this thing was wrong with the play.
Well, I had that with Katori Hall's Hurt Village.
Yeah.
They were like, this is just too much. We'd be like, this was 90 minutes of some people's lives. They live in that 365, 7 days a week. You couldn't do 90 minutes with these people?
And the people in the audience who see themselves represented, the Black folk who see themselves represented by that experience, they, in those same moments that white people are blaming them, that's what's wrong with your play, are like, that is the thing that made that play.
Yeah, that liberated me.
That is the thing that liberated. That was my cathartic moment in that play.
Yep.
Yes.
And so I would challenge these white students in these institutions that don't want to go outside of themselves, or these white audience members that are uncomfortable about going outside.
Yeah,
but they don't have to. But I would encourage them, do it.
For their own benefit.
For your own benefit. I ain't even encouraging no more. I don't even care. I ain't even invested no more.
Because if you're already comfortable and feeling good and you're living in a luxe apartment, why would you go?
And you got a TV series and you're getting Broadway shows. Why I got to learn August Wilson?
Because it's 2020 and the world is going to keep changing and you're going to be left behind.
Okay,
it's
going to
keep changing.
This is my mother question.
I love it.
Because I worry about this as a mother. So I have a lot of Black male friends who brag about my mother knocked the shit out of me and my mother slapped me down. And I remember the time I did this and my mother blah, 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 blah. I got some hands going up, but we can't see hands. You got to say, or yeah, something like that.
Been there.
Y'all had those mothers.
Yes.
So I had a mother who was violently, just brutally violent. And it is just something I could not do. I mean, I certainly tried to spank. And I can't do it. I mean, I experience such violence that I can't do it. And I worry, and I've had to say to my children, sometimes to my sons, like, maybe I have crippled you. But if you thought you was going to get a mama who was going to beat you and scream at you and all that, I'm not the one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the one. If that's the only thing that's going to motivate you, I'm not the one. I can't give it to you. Mm-hmm. And I worry about it, but then sometimes I go like, well, I'm so grateful that I can, financially support my kids. But then I remember like, nobody supported you. You was out there taking care of yourself and but it's like, I can't, put them out. I'm like, I can't put my kid out on the street when the world is like this and this and that. But I feel like a bad mother because I can't beat him. I can't scream at him. I can't put him out on the street. And I feel bad.
I don't think you should feel bad. Because I've been all the above. Beat, hit, all of it. And I remember growing up angry. And the only reason that it stopped when I got big enough and strong enough to fight back is when it stopped. And I always said if I had children, I would never. My little nephews, and when I see them, I will never whoop them. I would never. And I always wonder what the connection of that is toward slavery.
Yes.
And whipping and that way of discipline. I think.
But I feel like I'm as strong as I am because of what it went through. I mean, I feel like I went through such horrible shit that people today come to me and they offer me something like, what you got? You can't do nothing to me that I don't have done to me in my childhood. Bring it.
True. But are there other ways? But then there's trauma that goes with it too. I mean, it costs.
Agreed. But it did make me who I am.
Yeah.
And when I look at my children, I'm like, why am I having to take care of you? I was already doing this, that, and the other by the time I was your age.
I feel like I watched Cops and that was kind of enough for me. Like back in the 90s, Cops was nothing but Black men getting taken to jail, put in the back of a car. You didn't want that. Then you had the beat down of LA.
Rodney King.
And that was another reason why I was like, nope, I can't be bad.
Television as a deterrent.
Can't be bad, but you also can't be good and be black. So it was kind of this like, well, I see this on television. It's represented to me this way. And I'm growing up in Texas. So, I mean, I'm hypersensitive and hyper aware of always having to think of how other people are going to perceive me. No matter what I'm doing, right or wrong, like, I got to be on guard. So I feel like...
You internalized
it. I internalized it. And it has caused for a lot of anxiety and paranoia that I'm still working to unlearn and to deal with, which is very... I mean, that's my honest truth today is that the anxiety has been high for a while. And like people were doing that 10-year reflection on what it's like been from 2010 to 2020. And I remember everybody was leaving these positive things. And I just kept thinking, you know how many black people have died in the last 10 years? Do you know how we have survived and how we are still resilient as black people, still pressing forward to say we can do this, we can do better than we did last year? Like that to me is more powerful than like, well, I made this much money in 2006. Well... You know, 2016. But you know what I mean? Like, I feel like black people in the last 10 years have gone through so much and so much trauma of witnessing our people being shot and killed publicly, virally, mm-hmm. and no one's doing anything about it. So I feel like...
But the difference only is that we're seeing it. It was happening. Exactly. It's still happening. Right. Exactly. It's always been happening. It's just more visible. People get to suddenly pretend, oh my God, I didn't know that was happening, but that wasn't new.
It was until Emmett Till was on the cover of a magazine. Yeah. Right. You know what I'm saying? That's when people are like, oh no, we can't have this. You know, that magazine cover and that mother willing to show had happened to her son started an entire movement in the way I would say technology and social media and phone cameras on phones has ignited a new wave of action now.
I think we're all kind of going in the other direction where we're starting to get numb. Like, oh, yeah, another shooting. Oh, somebody else got killed. Yeah. Okay.
Got to a point where I was like, I just can't watch any more videos. I just can't do it.
I can't watch anybody else getting killed.
It's for my own health. And it's not that I don't care. I know that it's happening, but it's traumatizing. Yeah. You know, it's traumatizing to watch these videos over and over and over again. And every time there's a new one, it's like, I want to be part of the solution, but I can't be part of the solution at the expense of my own health.
Mm. And you can't heal yourself fast enough. That's the trouble. You can't, like, it happens so quickly and it happens so often. There is no time to heal. So you just kind of become this walking scar. And I guess, again, I want to emphasize that we are still smiling, still finding ways to laugh, and still
making
ways
beautiful
to love.
Work, just dazzling me on stage in Hot Wang Kang.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I will say with the mothering thing, I don't have no answers, but I will attempt to walk this line with y'all, like my experience with it. I was hit as a child. I don't know. I mean, I will say I learned a lot. This is one of the thoughts that's pressing on my mind. A lot of times I can tell the difference between people who were whooped and who weren't. Mm. You know what I mean?
How can you tell? What's the difference?
For some reason, I can just, they act a certain way. Some people walk with like a certain level of impunity through the world as if nothing can happen to them. And that is one thing I do appreciate that my parents did instill upon me. And I was lucky. I'm a very fast learner. So like, it didn't take very long. Like a couple of them shits.
One good crack.
Like, I swear to God, I'm like, two hands, I can count my whole life. Maybe one.
Yeah,
you know what
me
I mean?
Too. I'm
like,
and
so,
the same lines. Yeah.
Some of them were extreme. I've seen some really fucked up things happen to like friends and heard stories, and I will say that shit's crazy, but I do appreciate the fact that I understand that like it can end like that for me, not like for me, you, us.
Yes.
Like, you know what
yes
I mean? Like, it can end. Like, we can't just talk to anybody crazy. Like, we can't talk, and that's I think I don't have kids, so I don't know what I'm gonna do. But I do know they're not going to talk to me crazy because I can't. Like,
they will
you
not.
You have that kind of privilege out in the world.
You brought them in, you take right them out.
You know what I mean? Because better me than a cop, better me right than their, yes, their teacher. But they're not going to end up like Omari. They're not going to end up like them.
Right.
Like,
our
not
kids are more at risk.
If I have yes anything to say, that they will not end up like that.
See, so I let my kids say anything.
Oh, wow. Anything?
Yeah,
oh,
I do. Wow. I let them say anything.
But do you feel that has also shaped them to become more individualized than if you had tried to control them? Because I feel like there's the benefit to that of allowing them to say what they want to say, so that, I hate to compare them because I don't know your children, but Jaden and
Willow.
Like, I know a lot of people had opinions of those two as children, but I found them to be very brilliant. And as Jada and Will allowed their children to become who they are today, those two children are so smart and so opinionated, and they thought about what they have to say. So I feel like that's the benefit of allowing them to become themselves versus shifting them into this idea of who they're supposed to be in this world.
Well, I'm gonna accept that. That I definitely tell you, my children are all their own persons. I can't control nothing they say. I'm grateful that they speak to me and send their friends to me for advice. So I guess I did something right.
Yeah. I'm great. Yeah, I'm great. I think that it can be done both ways. I think that there is a way to raise children who are aware and respectful without
beating them. Yeah.
But at the same time, I also feel like, you know, I was, you know, I could on one or two hands, like the number of beaten whoopings I got. But what I think is it's important.
You was gay. You was gay in the Baptist
like,
church.
I got a whooping before I went places. Like, I'm going to give you a whooping before you do something.
That's too much. But I think it's important to know that the whooping is coming from a place of love.
Really?
And that is, I think
no,
it has to, yeah, no, because I think there's, no. But I think that's because there are a lot of people out here getting beat by family members that is not about them at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was mine. I was getting beat, but it wasn't about me.
And you probably knew that it was not about you. And that's my only thing is like, if I think you can sense when like, you kind of earned that whooping, and that it's coming from a place of like, you know, you did, and I'm gonna make sure that you're not gonna make this mistake again, as opposed to it coming from a parent or a relative or someone who is dealing something of
who's working
own,
their
who's,
own shit out on you
own shit
on
out
you literally.
I just had this experience down in Peru where I I have sort of had a lifelong low grade depression. But the way I deal with my depression is to get very active. Mm-hmm. Like the more depressed, the worse I feel, the more I'm going to do. I'm going to accomplish a whole bunch of shit. And I thought that had moved. Like I had gone for about a year and a half and I hadn't experienced that feeling. And then I went down to Peru to do some medicine work and it came up in this big way. Mm. And what that big way was I just always had the feeling that I just didn't want to exist. You know, it didn't matter how successful I was or whatever, it just wasn't worth it. And it came up huge when I was in Peru, and it was like, yeah, you could just check out now, your kids will get a lot of money and just check out now. And it was like, it was overwhelming me. And I went to the facilitator and he was like, well, when we do ceremony tonight, why don't you try to find the child, the little girl in yourself, and try to figure out the origin of that. And so what happened for me in the ceremony that night was, first of all, there aren't even that many pictures of me. I tried to find a photograph of me as a little person, and, you know, there's about five. And I found one, and I tried to talk to that part of me. And what it was I remembered being beaten when I couldn't have been more than two or three, and just being beaten so severely that I had to leave my body because I felt that I was going to die. And what came over me was that I was being beaten because I existed, because my existence had ruined my mother's life. My mother had me when she was 14. And so it was like, 16. Oh, of course you don't want to exist. Like, existence is a cause for you to be suffer very seriously. And, you know, I don't know if that'll come up for me again, but it moved it for a time so that it's not, you know, what I'm dealing with at, mm-hmm. at this moment, but that there was just that sort of low grade thing. I feel like this depression that I see in my students, my kids now, is the depression of the overwhelm of all this traumatic, horrible information that shows you how powerless you are. Yeah. Like, powerlessness for me always made me just want to die, because if I'm alive and I can't fix it, I don't want to be here. Mm-hmm. But it was always a single event. Mm-hmm. Now you like, there's 10,000 events every day that you are just powerless over.
Mm-hmm. Especially today, yeah. on this day.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think it's about, you know, I'm, as someone who's also, you know, I've experienced a low point, a crossroads, I'll say, in terms of like what life is, why are you here? What is the goal? What is the purpose? What is your purpose? And how to stay inspired and motivated and attach yourself to something bigger than yourself, I think is always, self-care is mm-hmm. is so crucial in terms of like knowing what is wasted energy, what is sucking energy and joy from your life, and shutting off all those doors. So I realized for me, part of it was like, turn off the news. like you know, like what's wasted energy? The news is wasted energy. You know, it's wasted, especially I've been talking, you know, this years ago, but it's like the time that you can spend with negativity, like if you can shut that up. For some people it's social media. Like if it's nothing but negativity for you, if it's dragging you down, turn it off. Like turn it off and attach yourself to more things that bring you joy. If it's creating art, create more art with telling stories that you are you know, proud of, with people who make you feel good. These are things you can aim for. These are attainable goals. These are attainable things that you can make a reality for yourself to keep yourself engaged in life, to engaged in your purpose and your reason for being here, because we're here for a reason. We're not accidents. We're not mistakes. We're here for a reason. And if we continue to attach ourselves to those things within us that bring us joy, the reason and the purpose will if it's not clear to you, it will make itself clear. You know, it will make itself clear, you know, over time, I believe. And it's just one day at a time, every day. You know, every day is a new opportunity to try again. And if we reinvest in each day, one day at a time, we can, you know, it's a ladder. We can build. And not that you won't slip back down. You know what I'm saying? You'll slip back a few rungs. Like, it's not, you know, it's a back and forth. But if your trajectory remains in the right direction, you can at least avoid the slide being back down the mountain, you know, because, you know, we all climb in the mountain. That's all we do.
Just thank you for saying that. I love you for being authentic and unapologetic about that. I think one of the things that my experience, especially with this show, has been seeing people after the show come up and talk about what they've experienced watching it, and mm-hmm. that they've gone through. I specifically remember a young woman named Gabrielle who came up afterwards, and she talked about how she was from Memphis and how she had recently come out to her family, and watching this show brought up so much for her, and she just started crying, and I was kind of like speechless. I didn't know what to say. But I don't think, looking back on it, that wasn't for me to say anything. It was for me to remember, like, this is what I'm
the
giving
power
to
of
people
theater.
on this stage, and if I can find a way to be selfless in the giving and not necessarily be so concerned with what people are going to say or think about it, then
this is the gift that then comes back to me is somebody just saying thank you. Mm-hmm. And it's, but I'm also learning, like, it can't just be about somebody else saying thank you. It has to be me saying thank you to myself for at least getting out of my own way to be present, to share this. Because that feeling of not wanting to exist or just being so overwhelmed and talked out like there's so much white noise going on that you can't even hear your own voice. Mm. That sometimes it's just taking that pause and moving forward with faith and going down that trajectory that then someone will cross your path and say thank you. Thank you for being you. Thank you for being authentic and thank you for being present. Because that, I think, is the hardest thing to do right now for me is to just be present. Because there's so much going on.
Okay, we're going to take a right turn. Hmm. Do any of you all watch Naked Combat?
Naked Combat?
Never heard of
what's
it.
What's that?
What?
I just guess they fight naked.
Oh my God.
You that's guys don't know Naked Combat?
No. First of all, what network is this? So is this on a network? What
that is this? This is going to be a house moment.
Freak house.
Are y'all really, honestly,
what are y'all, I really don't know what you're talking about.
Feeling. Well, I mean, we were talking about, you know, sexuality, and I was like, we always got to go out a little up. You know, we got so heavy and serious in there. That Naked Combat is, I find, one of the most sexy things I've ever seen. And it's two men who wrestle to the fuck.
Wrestle to
the fuck. Okay.
Wait a minute.
Oh, wait. That's okay. This is not a TV show. That's why I said, what network is this on? This is on.
It's a show.
It's a show on.
What this is?
Pornhub.
Or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Okay, so there you go.
We going to watch this?
Now we know what we talk about.
Y'all, nobody. I'm here.
We're going to bring it up.
I want to see how this devolves.
We about to watch it. I said, we about to watch it.
Honest to God, nobody's ever heard of Naked Combat. So look. We're all looking at a video of. Can someone make it come up? There it is. We're watching.
Can you cast it?
What I wanted to say about Naked Combat
is
that
the website that you found this on?
That a guy friend of mine told me about it. What I loved about it is some of my gay friends.
Lord, what this is? Let me watch this.
You gonna put it up?
No, I don't know how to do that.
Hold up.
You can airplay it.
Airplay it.
How do I airplay it?
Lord.
Naked Combat.
Who knows how to airplay?
I don't have Team Android over here.
Naked.
Okay, so what was interesting to me about it is that, like, I had a...
This was a right turn. This was not a right turn.
That's good. I'm here for it.
No, because I had this friend. He's not with us anymore. And he had been married to a woman for a very, very long time. And then they divorced. And he then thereafter had relationships with men. And one of the things he said about it was that when he surrendered in sex with a man, he felt like this man knew what the cost of the surrender was. Like the sex with the man was so full on that was, you know, that he loved it. And so Naked Combat was the the census.
Sorry, this just went up on the air.
let me get the right video.
That TV was blank before and then all of a sudden there was
but where's the show though? It's on AirPlay. So what had me thinking about it was this idea that when you see Naked Combat, it's two men. So it's there it is and it's trying to play. Two men. And the intensity of their energy is so, like, if it was a man and a woman, a man couldn't match this energy with a woman. It would feel violent.
Okay.
It would feel dangerous.
I hear you.
But when you see these two men coming at each other with this kind of energy, the virility is exciting and hot. And I find it incredible. It wouldn't be good with two women, but with two men, I find it very hot as we're watching porn videos here together.
This is the best podcast ever. I just want to put that out there. Wow.
What do you think?
But they're not really fighting. I see.
It's wrestling.
Really, but they're not really wrestling. Are you a wrestler? Aren't you a wrestler?
Did I embarrass you guys?
I didn't know that's not real.
What do you mean it's not real?
No, I mean, they're not really like trying to pin him down for a point of wrestling.
No, they're trying to pin him down for the point of sex.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to let that go. We're going to finish it up here. We're going to wrap it up because someone's coming in the door. Let's have my phone back, please.
Oh,
okay. Gentlemen, it was so wonderful.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, music by Anthony Norman, available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.